The New Quantum Era,
a podcast
by Sebastian Hassinger
and Kevin Roney.
Welcome to another episode of The New Quantum Era. I'm Sebastian Hassinger.
Hey, I'm Kevin Roney.
And today we are joined by Grant Salton, who's a quantum research scientist at the Amazon Quantum Solutions Lab at Amazon Web Services and a colleague of mine. I met Grant a little over a year ago when I joined AWS. And I really enjoyed my interactions with Grant. He's very, very good at explainers, I would say, and providing background and context for my limited kind of understanding of quantum information science. He has a particular sort of focus in his background on what is termed it from qubit. And so we thought he'd be a really good guest today to help us understand sort of the ramifications and context around a recent paper that Google and Caltech issued that generated quite a bit of buzz and not a little bit of controversy.
Yeah, a lot of splash in the media on that result. I mean, maybe if you're a listener, you've even saw that run on by these dramatic claims about wormholes and so forth. And
that's right.
A lot of spin. Maybe some marketing. Who knows? but you know, in digging into this subject in more depth, just on our own, I mean, we realize there's just a vast amount of actually quite compelling, interesting, and substantial theory right under the hood here that I found to be rather intimidating at first. I think Grant has done an excellent job on this episode of helping make more clear what we're talking about. Even then, it's some rather formidable mathematical abstractions. I warn the audience, there is some climbing ahead. But Grant does a great job, I think, right?
He really does.
Of bottom lining it and making it clear.
Yeah, he really does. I really enjoy it. So with that, let's get on to the conversation. Right, so we're joined today by Grant Salton, who's a colleague of mine. We both work at Amazon Web Services on the quantum team. And Grant is going to take us through some of the topic area of it from qubit, which I think is particularly fascinating. So,
cool and baffling topic. So, Grant, thank you.
Yeah, even
thank
more you baffling than the usual quantum stuff. So, to start with, Grant, would you mind sort of introducing yourself and providing a little bit of like, it's always interesting to hear how people sort of got into this field and found their way to this sort of new amorphous area of development that is quantum technologies.
Yeah, happy to. And thank you so much for having me. Great to chat. So, I mean, I started studying physics early on in high school. I planned to, going way back, planned to do engineering, but I really got into physics at that stage and found it pretty fun. So, and as an undergrad, I specialized in astrophysics with no focus on anything quantum. And always in the background, I was interested in something else. So I was trying to do astrophysics, but then focusing on or start studying cosmology on the side. I thought, all right, well, let's do some grad school in this. This is fun. So, wrapping up my undergrad, planning to do a cosmology master's, I took a class in quantum information theory, which was new for its time at the university where I was studying, and it was pretty fun. So when I started my master's, I thought, all right, well, I'm studying early universe theoretical cosmology, but this quantum info stuff was pretty cool, this quantum, quantum physics. So let's try to get into that a little bit more, try to see if I can find a way to put those two together. And in Canada, where I was doing my master's, you got 2 years. It's hard to get anything done in 2 years when you got classes and thesis, let alone trying to merge two things that don't seem to, there's not as much traction. So I finished that up and I thought, all right, well, from there, let's carry on. but I'm really digging this quantum info stuff. So put the cosmology side, so Mastro to Cosmo to quantum info. And I did that as, you know, full-time for PhD. But always trying to find a way to, you know, bring it back to something else that I found was super cool. Like I like working at the interface between different fields and different topics, applying the tools of quantum information theory to other areas of physics, or using different types of math to solve problems in quantum info or something like this, right? Just, you know, working at an interface between multiple things. And I did this, that was my plan for grad school. And I was very fortunate at the time that this It From Qubit collaboration sort of spun up around me, and that I was sort of steeped in it by other people, with other people that were sort of like-minded. And it was just very, very fortunate timing for me.
And what was it? Do you remember what was sort of the initial hook for quantum information that sort of started to drag you away from Cosmo?
You know, it's honestly, I think it was just the way I would think about problems seemed to make the most sense in terms of the language of information, right? Like I guess I'm one of these staunch supporters of the idea that really information is, it's not turtles all the way down. It's information at the very bottom, when you get down to brass tacks, it's information theory everywhere. Our reality comes from that. So that seemed to make, you know, the questions made sense, and the approaches to solving them made sense. And it just felt like a very natural, beautiful, elegant way of describing interactions in physics.
Do you think you encountered like Wheeler sort of It From Bit before quantum information, or quantum information and then sort of the It From Qubit sort of thinking, or was there any sequence to that?
I'd say it was probably the latter. I mean, my first quantum information theory exposure was through this really fun undergrad course. Maybe it was a grad course. I don't remember. I think I was auditing it either way. And that was more just about understanding like the math that's required, the density matrices, that kind of stuff, and getting into some of the details, but not really with a focus on it from bit. But nevertheless, it's kind of there. Yeah.
This makes sense. And I think just because this is a podcast on quantum computing and the numerous new results in quantum mechanics that are spinning off, I mean, such a cool subject. But I think for our audience, we might need to center this conversation in a way that makes sense against current events. I mean, the thing that really inspired us to invite you on was that big new result from Google around the quantum computing division speaking publicly about wormholes and so forth. It was a very, very confusing bit of press for us, right? And so we wanted to sort of dig into more substance on that. And so I think a parallel development, we need to brief our audience on, maybe for insiders like you, it seems obvious and true, but this whole It From Qubit movement has been a gigantic intellectual fountain, right? That's just sort of like sprouted up recently with like super high-end mathematicians and physicists collaborating on, I guess, a brand new notion of foundations of cosmology related to quantum information science. So there's these two big trends, this big splashy Google announcement and this huge intellectual movement. I mean, do I have the description right in terms of the context that helps, I think, describe current events?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that It From Qubit type, this intellectual movement has, as you say, it sprouted up somewhat recently and has included some of the biggest names anyway in physics as contributors. Right. And under that umbrella, that sort of way of thinking, there have been a lot of results that came out. And I'll take some liberties and classify some of these other things underneath being in under that umbrella, that way of thinking. I mean, so it from Qubit is this is going back to as Sebastian mentioned, right? John Wheeler had this notion of it from bit, that our reality is that all of the things that we would call it are the stuff that happens and the things we see. Those are at their core really just manifestations of information doing stuff.
Yes.
And that notion was pretty, he had a lot of foresight, and it was like 20 years later or more, right, that this started to take this a bit more seriously. And he was saying it from bit, talking about classical information, really zeros and ones, bits. But more recently, people saying, well, the world is inherently quantum mechanical, and the type of information that we really have as bedrock is quantum information. And the quantum systems have this different type of information that's not classical. Yes. And so this was now, it was going to be it from Qubit.
And Wheeler, so that's helpful. A 1989 paper where he sort of introduced that phrase, it from bit. I've read sort of analysis that in a sense that shifted the mission of physics from explaining, you know, the nature of matter to explaining how we perceive nature, right? Yeah. Like it turns into a system of understanding rather than a system of explaining. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, to some extent, I think that's probably a fair statement, right? He's trying to argue really that that way down, everything is information, and we just need to pay attention to the information content of the universe to really understand what's going on. And that a lot of these things are sort of manifestations. He has this quote that I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, and I'm probably going to get it wrong, or, you know, I honestly don't remember, but he takes 100% seriously the idea that, you know, everything we perceive is just sort of that our reality is fully just perception of information.
Right.
Our world experience comes from these quantum mechanical observables, so to speak. And the center of the theory.
And was it originally quantum? And I guess it was, but was it explicitly quantum in nature? And he was sort of saying, like, you know, like nature requires observation essentially in the way that we think about in quantum information science terms.
I think that's right. It's been a long time since I've seen this, but I think that's right. I mean, I think he's even talking about sort of the wave function and stuff in the abstract of that early paper.
Right.
So he was saying, yes, you know, we have this quantum mechanical reality, but nevertheless, all of the things we see and all of the clicks of detectors and that kind of stuff when we make measurements, this all boils down at their core to information, and we just really understand through that.
Right.
Yeah. So I think this is a really helpful, way to for our audience understand just the basics of that whole movement. Sure. Yeah, I'm wondering, Grant, can you help our audience, see with more clarity that recent result from Google? Because there was just widespread both criticism, right, of as if it sounded like so much hype, but also it feels like there's an understory which is compelling and real. I mean, even my son, my 17-year-old son, he was like, "Dad, that Google result, it's really," and he's like, "Is there a connection between entanglement and wormholes?" I'm like, "Whoa, good questions, young man. I don't really know."
I do want to say it feels like the concerns about this paper are really around the way the paper was conveyed to the general public.
Right? Yes,
you have headlines saying like Google researchers open wormhole with quantum computer, which I love, by the way. Before you jump in, Scott Aronson writing, if this experiment has brought a wormhole into actual physical existence, then a strong case could be made that you too bring a wormhole into actual physical existence every time you sketch one with a pen and paper.
classic Aronson too.
Very on
Aronson.
Brand. Yeah. 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 I hear a little bit of what you're saying there, right? So just to try to put some of this into context, right? So there was an experiment this year where some researchers from several different universities and also Google, they used a currently available quantum device that Google has to run an experiment on, I think, 9 qubits. And some number of gates, you know, quantum operations they were applying to those qubits. And what they were doing was they were trying to implement a proposal, an experimental proposal that came out a couple of years ago, that would try to demonstrate a phenomenon that looks like it would be a wormhole in some other description. So let's back up a little bit here.
Yes. Right?
Like we need to sort of set the stage. Well,
and how does that, my first read was, well, isn't that just teleportation, which is demonstrated all the time with qubits,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, easy
kind,
to do and
kind
gets
of,
good.
To some extent. Yeah, but a little bit of a different kind. So it turns out there are different types of teleportation, right? So all of this, so let's be clear here that there were no wormholes. There are no actual wormholes. There are black holes being created. Yeah, I mean, spoilers. Sorry. Yeah, I should put this at the start.
It's sort of like when they turned on the which one was it? Obviously the European one, but there is an American collider that was turned on, and they were like, "There's a small chance it'll open
this,
a
this might end the universe." Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And it did not.
They press pause to make sure the theorist had to make sure. Yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
So
right.
So here, all of these things are being done in the context of something called holography. So this is a description of This is a way of describing a physical system that is some kind of quantum system that has a different description in terms of a non-quantum system that looks like it has gravity. More concretely, that like there are different proposals for these holographic systems, and there are some concrete ones. A famous one is this ADS CFT, stands for anti-de-Sitter space conformal field theory. Don't need to know about the details, but the point here is that there are two pretty different looking systems. One of them is regular old, like Einstein gravity, basically, the sort of thing that people that Einstein would have called general relativity in a space-time that has a particular structure, has some kind of curvature. And that purely gravitational system is dual in a sense. Has another completely different description, but that is sort of in one-to-one correspondence in some particular sense, to a system that has no gravity. It just is it's a special type of quantum field theory that has a lot of symmetries called conformal field theory. And those two things that look very different, the conjecture was that they are really kind of the same thing in just different language. And then things that happen and properties and observables and physics in one system have a different description in the other system, that there's a dictionary between the two and you could sort of translate back and forth. And that sounds, you know, on the face of it, a little bit absurd, but there's a lot of evidence for this. And there's a lot of really nice math and some very simple, cool looking pictures that don't sort of translate here, but that make it look pretty, pretty nice, where to some extent, like there's this analogy that you can draw in some set of coordinates, you could draw this space-time, this anti-de-Sitter space-time, it looks sort of like a cylinder. And the conformal field theory, the cool thing about it is that it has one fewer spatial dimension. So if you had maybe a gravity in three dimensions, then this conformal theory is only in two dimensions. So it loses a spatial dimension. And so in some coordinates, you'd have this space-time as a cylinder, and you'd have the conformal theory as just sort of like the boundary of that cylinder. And so the analogy that some people like to make is that, well, think of that like a soup can. There's all this crazy stuff happening inside the can of soup. There's actual chunks of meat and vegetables floating around, and it's moving, and they're bumping into each other. And all of the crazy stuff that's happening inside the can of soup is actually just as well described by the properties of the electrons and all the little particles that are happening, that are zipping around on the surface of the can in that metal. And that, on the face of it, is why this is called holography to some extent, because you know, you lose a spatial dimension,
it's
and
a projection.
All of the stuff inside is also apparent on the surface.
Is it also accurate to describe that as sort of you can interpolate from really precise measurement of everything that the can is, you could figure out, you can interpolate what the contents of the can are just by the way that they're interacting with the can itself. Is that another way to describe that?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, okay. I'd say it's even stronger than that, right?
Like okay.
That all of the things that happen on the can are dual in some sense to what's happening inside the can, and vice versa.
Everything
that's inside the can is represented somewhere on the boundary in the metal, and everything that's happening on the metal is also happening inside the can.
So in some sense, language. Like the it is the soup and the qubit is the information about the soup that the can contains.
This is sort of like a more concrete,
it's a tortured realization metaphor at this point, but
yeah, pretty good, Sebastian, in real
I'm
time
hungry not now bad. Though
yeah, at some point some bread is going to enter this discussion. Sure. But so we have this cool description of the stuff that happens in a particular type of space-time, that this thing that I mentioned is called anti-de-Sitter space, which doesn't have the same structure as our universe, but it's still nevertheless like a cool toy model. We have another description of all of the weird gravitational physics that's happening in there, equally well described in terms of another very different system, this conformal field theory, or some other kind of quantum system. And so this is the sense in which you can say, I'm going to probe some properties of what's happening in the gravitational system by looking at a set of quantum degrees of freedom that are different. And the extension of this is to say, all right, well, I can represent some of the physics that's happening in this kooky conformal field theory, just in terms of some qubits on a quantum computer. I can represent a lot of the physics that would happen in that type of field theory, just in terms of some interactions, some gates that are applied to qubits, provided I do this carefully. And now the analogy is, all right, well, if I can study the physics in my qubits and say that this has a dual description in terms of gravity, then I should be able to describe the outcome of what I'm going to see in my experiment on the quantum computer in terms of the thing happening in space-time. And yes, that doesn't mean that there's like that I'm actually creating another universe of stuff. It just means that I have another mathematical way of describing
that's super
things.
Interesting. I mean, is another way of saying that if there were a tiny wormhole beside a quantum, or, you know, in a quantum system, beside a quantum system, or, you know, if there were soup in the can, you would expect to see those phenomena on the surface of the can. Right.
That's
but seeing the surface or replicating the results on the surface of the can doesn't make the soup appear.
That is right. That's true. That's true. And in fact, also, you know, it's not necessarily like when there was a step that I made there where I said, all right, well, I can try to represent some of the physics in this on the boundary of this can in terms of qubits. And unless I'm doing that very carefully and I'm making sure that I'm actually representing the right physics, I'm not even going to be able to say that there's a dual description in terms of gravity. So there wouldn't be a wormhole somewhere unless I'm sure that I'm doing the right experiment and I'm making sure that the physics is behaving as I would expect.
And how does that experiment or that line of thinking sort of deal with the lack of gravity? Like, you know, we don't have a connection between gravity in a macro, in a cosmological sense, and the absence of it in a quantum system, right? We don't know why gravity doesn't translate over. We don't know how it does. Is that right?
Well, okay. So maybe just as part of my answer here, let me preface this by saying, like, so why might we actually care about doing this mapping between these two systems? Like, what do we actually gain from saying, oh, well, I have all of this stuff here, but I can just describe it a different way? Why is that a thing we care about? The reason is that some of the things that are easy to talk about on one side of this duality, like some things that are really easy to describe in gravity, correspond to things that are really complicated, which we cannot write down in nice, simple terms the quantum side.
Yeah.
And things that we can describe very simply and clearly, and things we understand very well on the quantum side, often correspond to very complicated phenomena that we don't really understand on the gravity side.
And that makes perfect sense. I mean, a lot of mathematics results in recent decades. I mean, you're finding essentially isomorphisms with different geometries has led to gigantic breakthroughs in numerous different domains. So it makes exact sense now that, you know, if you could find a way to connect these two abstract models, you could really illuminate lots of the landscape. This is useful. Thank you.
And so this is the sense in which we can try to understand phenomena that looks really complicated and we don't really have a good sort of grasp on it on one side, in terms of something that we really do understand very well, because that is a very simple description on the other side of this duality. And this comes into the description of what's happening. You mentioned earlier teleportation, Sebastian. The description of what's happening in this experiment has in certain parameter regimes has an even better has a simpler, easier description in terms of particles moving through a wormhole on the other side, whereas it looks like some complicated quantum dynamics on the first side. I now realize that I've forgotten what your actual question was.
No, it's good. It's fantastic, this material, because you're getting right to the core question is, how do we describe in some, you know, deeper way the connection between this wormhole abstraction and issues of entanglement and teleportation? So you're saying there's these two different mathematical abstractions which have a tight interrelationship. It's almost an isomorphism, it sounds like, formally. And if you model in De Sitter space the notion of a wormhole, it's isomorphic representation. Sorry about the abstraction there. Over on the quantum information side, seems to exactly map to issues of entanglement and teleportation. Did I get that right?
Yeah, exactly. And so let's frame the question here, right? So early on, right, we have this duality between gravity and this type of quantum system. And people were saying, well, look, it turns out that actually if I have two of these universes, two of these spacetimes that are sort of separate, that's fine. I would just say, okay, well, I have also then two of the metal cans or something like that.
Sure, sure.
But now, since those metal cans are quantum systems, what happens if I just put them in some kind of really cool quantum state? I say that there's entanglement between them or something like that. What does that look like on the gravity side? And people managed to work this out. They figured out through that dictionary what this looks like. And it looks like you just sort of stitch together the two spacetimes behind a black hole so that, you know, there's a black hole in one and a black hole in the other, and the interiors of those black holes are somehow stitched together. And, you know, what does that mean? That's one of the questions that this IFRIN community wants to get to. But it looks like a wormhole where if you're in one universe and the person in a different universe and they both jump into the black holes, they could talk to each other once they're behind it, but they could never transfer to the other side. And then some smart people said, all right, well, actually, it looks like actually, what happens if I apply some gates, some operations on these two quantum systems, the two metal cans that sort of span both sides? Then it looks like when they went through this mapping, it said, just tried to describe it in terms of gravity, said, oh, it looks like actually we open a wormhole that a particle could go through.
Wow.
And there's some cool math to describe this, and you have to do some, and this isn't something that we're going to be doing in like in the real world, because this is two toy models of gravity and we're applying.
I saw Ant-Man. I know how this works.
Yeah. But nevertheless, right, like mathematically, this looks like a wormhole that opens up in such a way that a particle could go through it. And then there was a question,
is it the particle or the information that represents the particle?
Well, is it the it or the qubit?
Right, so, exactly.
So, yeah. I mean, are those different things?
I don't know. Like,
yeah. We're getting a little philosophical here.
Yeah, right? We're going to epistemology. Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly.
Dangerous territory.
right. We'll change topic for the
No, I love this topic. Are you kidding?
So the question then was, all right, well, I managed to open this wormhole in these toy models of gravity. What's the description of that? In terms of the physics, the quantum physics, like what is the dual description that we can understand in terms of qubits and gates acting on them on a quantum computer? And the gravity side, all right, I made it sound a little bit, it sounds kind of complicated. I've got these entangled space-time and stuff. It's not so bad, right? It's just imagine a wormhole somewhere and you send a particle or a person or a bit of some information through it. That you can visualize. You just, you know, throw a book into a black hole and it pops out the other side of a different black hole. The dual description of this is some complicated, well, it's not so complicated, but like some particular protocol that needs to happen in these boundary quantum systems, right? You have to do some kind of chaotic dynamics. It's really, really messy. You have to apply these gates between them and suddenly the information comes out. And it looks sort of miraculous to some extent. It's almost like you're saying, all right, I have, scream into a hurricane, my message, the words I say just get completely mixed and scrambled up in the hurricane. And then somewhere on the other side of a football field, my message just suddenly comes out.
It somehow gets reassembled and boom, spoken clearly. Yes.
Without any understanding. And that there's some weird, you know, like obviously something interesting is happening there. And you say, well, what? How can I describe that? And it turns out that for the protocol I described on this quantum device or the system that we're talking about, the most natural or the, I shouldn't say natural, the simplest description of what's happening here is that if you think of this as a gravitational system, it's just a particle moving through a wormhole.
Wow.
And so this was what the experiment was trying to do. I mean, they had to try to find the smallest system that they could represent that would nevertheless have the physics that they needed to do. And they used some machine learning techniques to try to find a smaller system with simpler interactions that still behaves as they wanted. And then it was about just implementing the protocol. And to be clear, just, you know, stating it once again, nobody opened any wormholes anywhere. And also it was a small enough, the point was that they needed to bring the system size down small enough that you'd still be able to see the signal that this was working through the noise of the fact that these are messy computers.
So that's what I was going to ask. So you said there's, you know, chaotic dynamics. So you use the hurricane as the example. So were they purposefully sort of trying to create those chaotic dynamics yep. in their circuit, or were they using the noise of a NISQ machine as the stand-in for the hurricane? Because it is sort of a hurricane of noise.
Yeah. Okay. You sort of want a hurricane in a different sense, right? You need the chaotic dynamics to really mix the information rather than just, you want
right.
it to
dissipate
mix it in
it.
A,
yeah.
exactly. You want to keep the information there rather than let it leak out into the environment.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
you want it to be all spread amongst the different qubits.
Right. I guess that's true. Noise in a current quantum system is actually like leaking into the outside environment, which makes it just go away, essentially. I mean,
it doesn't have to be, right? Like you could have unwanted coherent noise between yeah. qubits. You could do yeah. this, but you know, the net effect and the overwhelming
time,
effect for
yeah.
the time for right now, current generations.
Random. Yeah.
It's leakage.
Cool.
Yeah.
So then they created this chaotic dynamic, sent the information into it, and then the information appeared on the other end of this chaotic dynamic.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. You have you sort of have a bunch of qubits. You're going to think of half of them as one side of the wormhole and the other half as the other side of the wormhole. You apply some chaotic dynamics, scrambling dynamics is the term that we like to
yeah.
use. And then you have to do this. You have to do this interesting interaction between the two sets of qubits that I mentioned. That corresponds to coming back to the gravity side. That means that corresponds to acting jointly between the two different space times, or in the field theory example, acting with some two sided operator. But in the quantum computer, it means applying a particular gate to a large subset of the qubits. And then there's some more chaotic dynamics that happened. Some of these are sort of forward evolution and others are backward evolution, but in the end, it's still all kind of random scrambling dynamics. And you find that the signal sort of returns.
I mean, in many ways, this is really such an impressive tour de force, right? I mean, there's like all this, you know, really powerful underlying mathematics of the isomorphism between these systems, this visionary concept of how epistemology, right, of cosmology can work, and just these really cool efforts at Google and the team that surrounds them around these quantum computing circuits and machine learning models to simplify it enough. I mean, wow, it's just so impressive. So I don't want to sound too crass here, but I'm just trying to help us get to bottom lines on, Is there a way that there's commercial applications of these new results, or new conclusions about science that we could reach or feel more comfortable with? Because, I mean, in some ways, one could sort of critique this as sort of saying, "Well, look, there is a well-known isomorphism, and then we did it on a quantum computer." Yeah, it's just maybe that verifies the theory, but is it a deeper breakthrough than that? Help us understand
sure.
the merit, the significance of the result.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, right, it's a small enough circuit that it's 9 qubits, so we can simulate this on our laptop without the
yes.
noise.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So, so we knew what the result was going to be, right? Like we have theory that tells us exactly what the result should be, and this was an experimental demonstration that sort of validates the theory that we
right.
expected.
Yeah.
So from this specific experiment, we didn't learn something new. This was sort of a proof that, or this was an experimental demonstration
sure.
of what we were that it works as
yeah,
expected.
Reproducibility, right, of results, really important for science. Yeah,
crucial. Yeah, yeah. There was sort of like a newer component to this, which was that the machine learning, right? Like in order to get a small model, something that would run on a quantum computer, you could take the kind of dynamics that we need, the kind of system we need, and it sort of. It's a bit larger. So they had to go and find a smaller subset of this that nevertheless maintains the properties of the system
right.
that they wanted
yeah.
to simulate in a smaller set of degrees of freedom. And so they were training in such a way that they were able to bring down the total number of qubits and operations while still preserving some of the properties that are needed.
Which was such a cool way to approach that. I mean, it's reminiscent of a lot of the work that was done in spintronics recently, right? Where they're trying to figure out like these new exotic computing architectures, how to simplify the underlying circuits using ML. I mean, really, really novel and interesting.
I think there's a lot of work that can be done using classical machine learning to bring down the resource costs for quantum computers and things like that.
There's huge commercial applications there for the future. Sounds like
down the road. Yeah, once we've got these devices in the, let's say, the medium term. Once they're large enough, we can do something cool, but nevertheless not sufficiently large that we have an unlimited number of resources. We're going to have to find ways of bringing down our resource costs.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that kind of idea has some merit. So in this specific experiment, I would say, you know, we didn't discover something that we had not seen before. This was a verification of the theory that, and nevertheless, you know, you could simulate this on a laptop. But as for future generations of hardware come online, we could start to modify the experiment such that we are probing things that we hadn't tried before, and see if we can understand something new about, let's say, quantum gravity in this anti-Sibber state, this toy model that we like. And that could start to give us some new insights that maybe we hadn't thought about in the past.
Pretty interesting. And also in terms of theory in physics, I mean, this does not give more momentum to the so-called EPR conjecture. I mean, I guess that's one of the major conjectures by Susskind and others around the interrelationship between entanglement and advanced gravitational theory. Does this, you think, maybe advance that cause at all?
So for those who might not be familiar, right? So this ER equals EPR. This is a claim that wormholes or connections between potentially distant regions of space time have to do with entanglement in some underlying quantum description of that space time. And you know, the concrete realization of this in this ADS-CFT tin can do correspondence is what I mentioned before, that if you've got two of these spacetimes that are stitched together behind a black hole that looks like a wormhole, that corresponds to an entangled state on the boundary. Mm-hmm. That's a necessary ingredient in this experiment and this whole thing. One of the starting points for the protocol, this quantum protocol, is to construct a highly entangled state that looks kind of like a maximally entangled state, but where, you know, which has, you know, the most amount of entanglement between the different sides, different constituent parts. But here the sort of the amplitudes, the terms in the sum sort of decay according to some distribution. And that looks like that particular state that you have to construct is the thing that has as a dual gravitational description a non-traversable simple wormhole where you just take two black holes and you stitch their behind the horizon regions together. So that is EPR. ER equals EPR at work. And this acronym as well, by the way, is like Einstein-Rosen equals Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen. two of them talked about wormholes, and three of them talked about entanglement.
Not the actual humans equaling each other, though, just to be clear. And bringing Einstein into this and the connection to Hawking and the information paradox of black holes, I mean, is that result that there was that sort of breakthrough paper that sort of culminated the search for the solution, the information paradox that basically described this sort of the information being turned into hair around the outside of the black hole that got reconstituted as the black hole evaporated. And in fact, that was when you were describing it from qubit to Eddie Farhi at Q2B last year, you used that metaphor of the, you know, yelling into the hurricane and then having the the words reconstitute as the hurricane died down. So there's some kind of combination between the solution, the information paradox of black holes, and this experiment. Is that right?
And this experiment, I'd have to think about this a little more. I mean, I will say that, right, like one of the crowning achievements of the It from Qubit collaboration that sort of happened were a couple of papers a series of papers kicked off by two that gave more credence to the idea that information is not really lost from black holes, right? Like there's this age old information paradox that as you throw information into a black hole, it radiates it away in purely thermal Hawking radiation that doesn't tell you anything about what went in, but as it loses that information or that energy, it shrinks and eventually disappears. And so information seems to be lost in black holes, violating quantum mechanics. At some point Hawking would, I think himself said that this is likely not actually going to happen. The information does come out, but in this holographic quantum gravity toy model, there you can see this a bit more explicitly that, you can say, all right, if I had a black hole in my space-time, I can talk about the dual description in the quantum sense, and I can say, is there a way in which I can, like, how much of the interior space, how much of the space-time can I recover, can I talk about on just the boundary? And it looks like, for the most part, you can only really talk about the stuff that's outside the horizon. But I guess a series of papers, they found another way, another description where you are able to say, aha, if I am able to capture the information that comes out, the radiation that comes out of the black hole, and I lock it away, I don't really need it. But I treat the fact that it's evaporating very carefully. They discovered that, oh, it looks like actually I am able to represent some of the interior of the black hole in terms of this outside quantum description, which we hadn't seen before. And this led others to be able to write down more concretely the Hawking's original calculation of black hole evaporation by finding other, let's say, other terms that were not easy to see, but are now apparent when you look at things through this cool new lens. Wow. That helped to sort of resolve that information paradox.
Deep. Yeah, really interesting.
So, okay. I mean, the thing they refer to as hair is sort of the information sort of being preserved holographically on the outside of the black hole. Is that right?
I guess, yeah. I mean, people have different different meanings when they talk about black hole hair. So, but I think what you're saying, right, is that, yeah, indeed, right, that there's a, like, black holes were one of the first things that people used to describe a holographic system, where they were saying, like, I guess back in the 70s, early 70s, maybe 72 or something, Bekenstein pointed out that the entropy of the black hole scales as the area, the surface area of the black hole. You know, you've got this big, large region of space-time, and I can fill it with as much stuff as I want, and nevertheless, the entropy, which kind of describes how much information is in it, scales with just the surface area. And that was suggesting that the inside of this is dual to just the boundary. And that was one of these evidences that maybe there are systems that have a holographic description.
Oh, interesting. So that was one of the first observations that kicked off this whole
track. Yeah, it's one of the first ones. And this claim that the entropy, this measure of information content or something to some extent, depends on just the area of the black hole. That manifests very clearly in this ADS-CFT correspondence. And so there you can kind of very, very naturally describe or represent the fact that this black hole has an entropy that looks like just its boundary. That comes out from some of the recent results, or the more recent results, I guess like 2006, there was one that you can use to describe this. It's very nice to see that some of the early work has a much clearer description in these toy models.
So there's clearly value in this quantum information experimentation for our understanding of the universe. Is there the sort of the direction in the other direction, sort of learning where understanding black holes or wormholes or holographic universes can help us with things like quantum error correction? Because I've heard those two things sort of that connection being made too.
That's one of the big hopes of the from qubit movement, is that actually this is a two-way street.
Right.
There's been a lot of, I think there's been, I mean, just my own guess, and I've sort of lost touch a little bit, but that is that most of the results do go in the one way of saying, here are some new insights into the ADS-CFT gravitational high energy physics problems that people think about when you phrase it in terms of information theory. And I think that was to be expected, at least to me anyway, because you're just using information theory as a tool, as a way of describing these other systems. And that gives you other techniques that maybe you just hadn't realized before, which are natural in this language, this different way of, you know, this other math. But going the other direction and say, well, here is something where gravity has taught us about quantum computing. That's a little bit of a harder ask, but there's some examples, right? So you mentioned that space-time kind of looks like a quantum error correcting code. And that was, you know, that was another one of these crowning achievements of this collaboration, is that indeed that seems to be true in these holographic quantum systems. Lenny Susskind likes to say this, right? That the hooks that bind the space-time together is entanglement. And in particular, the structure of that entanglement we're discovering is a quantum error correcting code. And so by trying to figure out what that quantum error correcting code is that represents the space-time in terms of the boundary, that gave us these new holographic quantum error correcting codes and some of the tensor network tools used to describe them. So that was sort of a new a new approach, and we can use those for.
And which, I mean, are there specific codes that, that were informed by that? I mean, is that the, you know, the, like the surface codes, is it the, which sort of family of error correcting codes are influenced by that?
The ones I have in mind, I mean, they're, people tend to reference them, refer to them as holographic codes. They're sort of these, they kind of look like concatenated codes where you start with a quantum error correcting code, and then you sort of like recursively encode each one of those little things out and further on and sort of proliferates out. The reason for this is because you kind of, as you, it turns out that in this, in the, on the gravity side, if you want to represent something that's really far into the space time, that's nowhere near, like, you know, deep in the center of the can, that requires a description that's sort of, that uses most of the metal around it. If you want to represent stuff that's very close to the can inside the, you know, like a piece of soup that's very close to the can, you only need to really think about the part of metal that's very close to it. And so there's, there's this, this notion that you have to kind of, the further in you go, the more encoded it has to be. And this is where you get these kind of recursive codes coming out.
So interesting. It's been a gigantic year this this past year on quantum error correction. Like numerous big, big results hitting. I mean, what do you think? Do you, is it your, I don't know, thesis that this holographic thread of research could be even bigger news than what's happened this, this past year?
I don't know that it'll be bigger news, right? Like, I think the stuff that's happening this year is there's some really important results. And I think the work that the folks are doing on making quantum error correction actually, you know, getting to the point where it's going to start giving us...
Yeah, that gets over the threshold of recoverable error.
That's crucial. I think we need more of this. Let's have more of those folks. the holographic stuff, I think, is nice. Finding applications of this, that's something that I still think we need to do, right? And to, for myself, my own, you know, coming back to the very beginning, right? You're asking my journey into what I'm doing now, right? Like I was working on this holographic stuff and the quantum error correction, these quantum error correcting codes for space-time and things like that. And I was trying to find ways of making it a bit more practical or like use new near-term devices to simulate these and trying to make things a bit more tangible. And I think that needs to happen, right? I think that would be really exciting if we were able to take some of the findings from this, this umbrella of ideas and say, this is really cool. And look, it has this practical application.
Right. Well, I mean, especially the way that you described the Google and Caltech teams working with ML to reduce the complexity of the circuit for this experiment. I just wondered, like, you know, that's the problem with a lot of the sort of theory around error correcting codes is it's extremely hard to implement on the machines that we have today. So I just wonder if there's a similar kind of effort that could go into, you know, finding simpler implementations of this, of all this math.
Yeah. Well, I guess one of the upsides is that I'd say it feels like there's a lot more work happening in tensor networks these days. And this is a way of representing quantum systems that can maybe be more efficient or something like this. And by virtue of being exposed to them through some of these results, like this holographic quantum error correction, stuff like that, we've got more people that are familiar with these techniques than were in the past, I would say. And it's a very broad, widely applicable way of thinking about quantum systems. And it has the benefit of also being something that you could just simulate classically in an efficient way. Some of the more efficient simulations of complicated quantum systems use these tensor network methods.
Right.
And indeed, I'd say already, I can think of a couple examples where people who have become, let's say, experts in tensor networks have been able to say, cool, now I can solve a problem that people actually care about in the real world using these methods more efficiently. Even if it's not really quantum just yet, but it's like, you know, it's bridging connections between different things, and that's always a good thing.
Yeah, because there's tons of machine learning and data science that depend upon tensor calculations. So yeah, there's a huge amount of
frontier there. Is it the sparseness of the tensor network? Is that what, like, if you can trim it down to sort of the minimal entanglement required for the problem, then that makes it more tractable by classical simulation? Is that?
I think that's a good way of putting it. I mean, there are other reasons why this would be the case, but yes, in general, like if you have something that where it has a lot of structure and the way the entanglement spreads is sort of is itself also quite structured, then you can do a pretty you can do a much more efficient simulation of this. The scrambling circuits, this real scrambling that you need to generate this hurricane and these wormhole papers, that has information spreading through entanglement as quickly as possible. And so there, the point is that it gets really hard to simulate that really quickly. And this is why it's a really quantum chaotic scenario.
Interesting. Wow. Do you think there might be a path towards using this wormhole simulation experiment in as a sort of next generation supremacy test, like a benchmarking test, like using it to prove that a piece of hardware can do something that's intractable classically?
I mean, I guess you would need much larger system sizes to be able to get some of these, right? Like, the challenge with these supremacy results is that you need to be able to find something that you can do where you can tease out a signal and still get your answer despite all the noise. And here in these wormhole things, you're already looking for a signal, not just, so you don't necessarily get to maximize the signal. Like, you don't get to choose which signal is going to be the strongest one that you can pull out. There's one that you have to look for. And so in that sense, maybe, like, I would love if this turns out to be the case. I think that'd be super fun. If these ideas could be used to demonstrate the real power of quantum computers when we couldn't do it classically, I think that'd be super fun.
And it's, I think, just that's the way you described that the entanglement is achieved as quickly as possible. That sounds like, it's relying on the capability and the performance that are intrinsically quantum in nature. And therefore, intuitively, it sounds like something that would be pretty easy to find the boundaries of what you could simulate classically.
Yeah. But on the other hand, right, so some of the early demonstrations of supremacy were themselves implementations of random quantum circuits. And a random circuit will sort of scramble information. But to do that as quickly as possible, you want the random circuit to be able to sort of couple qubits that are on, let's say, different sides of the chips as easily as the ones that are nearest neighbors. Yeah. And if your architecture only allows, interactions close by, you have to work around that. And so to really scramble as strongly as you might need for some of these experiments, you might need longer circuit depths, which might require better.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what I'm kind of thinking. There's the recent paper that sort of put forward a theoretical proof of the limitations of the Google random circuit sampling experiment, showing that basically the larger the system, the more quickly the simulation breaks down, and the weaker the supremacy claim, right? At this level of noise, essentially, which is, that's to be expected. I'm just wondering if there may be some merit to this scrambling circuit as a benchmark for like next gen hardware that's hopefully less noisy and more capable.
if you could do this, if you could really implement these sort of all to all or long range gates,
or just super high gate rate. Like, I mean, in superconducting qubits, tend to have nearest neighbor, and if you like heavy hex, for example, in the IBM case, it's not all to all, but you affect that entanglement at a distance, let's say by a whole bunch of swaps, right? So if the performance is high fidelity enough and fast enough, you'd be able to do that maximum entanglement or near maximum. You said it wasn't maximum, but the scrambling circuit function efficiently on a fast enough and high fidelity enough quantum computer.
That's very true. Yes. The larger the system, the more swaps you need. And so you really need to, like, it's
a good,
it becomes
test
a much
fidelity.
More demanding thing. Exactly. That's right. Yes. It's testing your ability to control like different qubits and the gate fidelities and the coherence times all need to be good. So the better, the larger the system you want to do, the harder it becomes in a few dimensions. And I think so for that reason, it could be a very strong
benchmark. And all very contemporary engineering problems. They still are.
Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely. Hard.
Exactly.
Hey, I just got to reflect on this conversation because I had a grand time going through this material. Thank you so much, Grant, for your contribution here. Yeah, I mean, just reflect on it. This is almost a multi-course meal of like really rich, fun abstraction.
Soup. Lots of soup.
We had mathematical isomorphisms into anti-de-Sitter spaces, relativity, quantum information science, chaos theory, ML, quantum error correction. I mean, it just goes on and on.
Tensor networks.
Entanglement, the whole, I mean, geez, that's just about as good as it gets if you're into that nerd thing.
Buzzword bingo here, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
What do you, I mean, if you look forward, like, what do you think are sort of the big, if any, challenges that are identified by the from Qubit crowd? Is there something else that people are sort of shooting for as a result, or?
I mean, there was a lot of work. There's sort of a lot of work on really understanding in detail this sort of information paradox, let's say resolution. Yeah. You know, it led to a lot of deep insights into how information can be recovered in the quantum systems, and trying to understand that in depth took people sort of to, you know, that became a whole new sort of dimension of research. I think a lot of people are trying to understand, all right, well, we've got this great toy model of ADS CFT, and ADS is anti-de-Sitter space, but we live in de-Sitter space. So what do we do here? How do we make this a bit more realistic for ourselves? And there are efforts to try to understand how to to understand whether or not we could have a toy model similar to this that's more akin to our own current reality, or to understand the dynamics of flat space, which is also sort of like, you know, a reasonable approximation, even if our full universe does not look like this right now. And so I think those kinds of questions, how to push this on the gravity side, how to push this into a realm that's not a toy model that is very fruitful, but nevertheless not corresponding to our universe, but something that's maybe closer to us. On the quantum side, I think there's still a desire, as you said, to try to get more mileage out of this way of thinking. Take the other tools and see if we can use them to learn something about quantum information theory, quantum error correction. And then further than that, I think depending on who you ask, there is still an appetite to also try to understand if these kinds of experiments, like this wormhole kind of thing, if we can use near-term quantum devices, we've got them. What are we going to use them for right now? And the most likely thing is just, you know, experiments and understanding simulations of physics. And I think
real results of significance for deep science.
I keep making the same joke, but the quantum computers we make today are kind of crappy computers and really exotic lab instruments, right? Like, there's all kinds of really interesting science that's being done on these devices.
So. That's right. Yeah. And I think there's a lot that we can learn on sort of both sides, right? Like, as you were pointing out, we learn what it would take to be able to run more complicated physics experiments in terms of engineering. How do we have to build these devices to be able to simulate physics outside of the simpler things that we can do right now? And also, can we use them to understand new things that we hadn't yet discovered about some of these physical systems that we're studying from a theory perspective?
That's fantastic. Well, we'll keep you on speed dial for future Hit from Qubit results.
Yeah, that was so cool, really, really Grant. Really, yeah. Thank you. Yeah,
please do.
Really
fun. Super fun for me too. I'm glad I get to chat about this. You know, these days I think about more practical applications of quantum computers. So I love getting the chance to riff about this stuff.
Yeah, awesome. Good times. Yeah,
thank you so much.
Well, thank you both.
Wow, that was great fun, Sebastian. Grant really brought it on. I mean, I got to say it again. I mean, that whole that menu of really rich abstractions, you know, mathematical isomorphism and anti-de-Sitter spaces, general relativity, wormholes, entanglement. I know, and machine learning results to somehow get to the right circuit of the quantum computer. I mean, wow, that was a rich multi-course deal.
It really was. Yeah. And I almost feel like we need another episode to sort of go through the glossary that you ran through.
It's true, my God.
10 minutes of context for each one. But yeah, it was really great. And, you know, the reason that I'm so drawn to it from Qubit is that it's such a great example of these emerging, I would call them scientific use cases, where these devices that we're building today are enabling new science, new experimentation, not just validation of claims, which is important in and of itself, as we were saying, but also breaking new ground on our understanding of the universe itself, which is really incredibly interesting and exciting. And at the same time, the science is causing the engineering and the technology to stretch in ways that are making it more likely that we'll find our way to devices that are actually useful, fault-tolerant, universal computers that are useful for, you know, industry, commercial purposes, right? So it's this fascinating, often in physics, I've run across this term co-design, and it's where experimentalists and theorists work together.
Yes.
And now we're seeing an expansion of co-design into engineering and technologists in a way that I think is incredibly exciting.
Yeah, really neat. Yeah, such a good time. I'm glad you found this guest.
Absolutely. So that's it for this week's episode. We apologize for the delay since the last episode. We're going to continue to try to get these out every couple of weeks. There was a little bit longer delay before this one, but we hope to see you on the next episode as well. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks.
Okay, that's it for this episode of The New Quantum Era, a podcast by Sebastian Hassinger and Kevin Roney. Our cool theme music was composed and played by Omar Costa Hamido. Production work is done by our wonderful team over at PodFi. If you are at all like us and enjoy this rich, deep, and interesting topic, please subscribe to our podcast on whichever platform you may stream from. And even consider, if you like what you've heard today, reviewing us on iTunes and or mentioning us on your preferred social media platforms. We're just trying to get the word out on this fascinating topic and would really appreciate your help spreading the word and building community. Thank you so much for your time.